As James and I talked about tonight, I expressed that I didn't really want to do a PowerPoint. I wanted to look at faces and be with you. And so I don't have a polished presentation. What I have are some thoughts on my own journey and a confession to make at the start that this is really the first time I've ever done some serious thinking about living with depression. I've done some acknowledging in other places, and so I'm a bit nervous about this, but I appreciate the chance to be with you. And I guess I want to move in three moments. You know, if you think about it, like James mentioned, I'm a musician. I think of like a chord, you know, with three notes, a triad, that maybe at the end may sound together to create a big picture. But one, I'll begin with some general issues about language and beginning with some statistics and stigma, and move secondly then into something of my own story, speaking about experience living with depression. And then finally, third, open up into some, because James did acknowledge I'm a theologian, and I've really sought attentively to think through scriptures and to think through resources for building community with and among people with mental health challenges. So having said that, I'll begin with some statistics because it's very real and living. This isn't a kind of story about those other folks. It's a story about us as a community and becoming a richer us. So I did some searching from the Canadian Mental Health Association and found that before the pandemic, and I'll mention the pandemic rates in a second, but more than 6.7 million people in Canada live with a mental health condition. More than 28% of people aged 20 to 29 experience mental illness in a given year. 28%. Approximately 8% of the adults will experience major depression at some time in their lives. About 1% of Canadians will experience bipolar disorder, what used to be called manic depression. And schizophrenia affects about 1% of the Canadian population. Anxiety disorders affect 5% of household populations, ranging in the impairments related to it. Suicide accounts for 24% of all deaths among those who are 15 to 24 years old, and 16% of deaths among those who are 25 to 44. Really notable statistics. The mortality rate due to suicide among men is four times the rate that it is among women. So we can come back to that in terms of major depression and some societal norms that may be a factor. What's really interesting is you probe further into the statistics is that almost one half, 49% of those who feel they suffer from depression or anxiety have never gone to see a doctor about the problem. Half of those who report somehow feel disinclined or dissuaded by their communities to not seek help. We'll talk more about that too, because that's an indicator. Once depression is recognized, however, 80% of those who sought help received benefit. So the statistics about actual help for depression is good. But one factor looms large in it all. Stigma or discrimination attached to mental illnesses presents a serious barrier, not only to the diagnosis and treatment, but also to acceptance in the community. There were two Canada statistics reports that I sought, one in 2004, that represent higher rates of the experience of stigma than the 2014. People did seem to feel that stigma is less an issue as time goes by, but many, upwards of 25%, still experience stigma with related to mental health. And according to Statistics Canada, and this is really important because I see you're having a session on anti-Black racism, so it's important to mention here, the Statistics Canada, Canadians in the lowest income bracket are 3 to 4 times more likely than those in the highest income bracket to say that their mental health is fair to poor. And poverty includes racialized communities. Black, Indigenous, and other people of color rate significantly higher in reporting mental health challenges and in lack of accessing resources for support in their community. That's notable too. If you add COVID-19 to the mix, maybe some of you saw it. It made some of the newspapers recently. Mental Health Research Canada released a latest snapshot of Canadian mental health during the pandemic. And this was taken in December, between December 10th and December 18th. The report, the poll that was taken, found 22% of the Canadians surveyed reported they had been diagnosed with depression. If you think about that, 22%, that's a much higher rate than pre-pandemic, significantly higher. Understandable, with another 20% saying they've received anxiety disorder diagnosis. Both of these, the report acknowledged, are the highest that the Mental Health Research Canada has ever measured, and 4 percentage points higher than pre-pandemic. So self-reported feelings of general anxiety and depression were also found to be at all times highs. So COVID, it's particularly timely that you're having this because COVID is affecting mental health. Maybe you've experienced it. I have experienced it. The sense of isolation and disconnect has an effect. And this effect is particularly pronounced in racialized and impoverished communities, who often suffer from COVID at a higher rate too, if you look at the statistics. So, I mean, thinking about Martin Luther King's birthday, it's really important to connect racial justice with mental health and addressing our communities. It's also important to recognize that our society idealizes and even worships a kind of body that is white, male, heterosexual, able-bodied, neuronormative. I've learned that language from my life with my son diagnosed on the autism spectrum. But a society that privileges some bodies over and against others actually then can increase the percentage of those who suffer from mental health challenges in those communities. Anti-Black racism affects communities, and trauma is often a result. And I'm sure you'll talk more about this. And so Sarah Lund, who's a United Church of Christ advocate on their mental health network, wrote, "The journey of liberation of one person is connected to the journey of liberation of us all." In honor of Dr. King, it's important to remember that from the very start. So those statistics really do frame the thoughts that I'd like to share with you today, and highlight the need for faith communities to be responsive. I'll say a word about befriending and why it's in scare quotes, because I speak in a certain sense very resistant to the notion of befriending. I don't find depression a friend of mine. However, having said that, and I'll say more a little bit later, I find that it's important not to treat it as an enemy that constantly besieges me, under which I have no agency and no power. So it's a dance, and I'll dance a little bit later and talk about it, but it's interesting to raise that because it raises the problem of language and how we speak and name and describe things. We all know, because it's so beautiful to say, the former president of the United States used language to distort and confuse and divide. We saw the power of language. And the power of language and how he names things, you know, it orients us to the world. It shapes our behaviors, as we saw in the riot and the insurrection of the Capitol. But I want to bring it home to mental health. Language can open up possibilities, but can also limit and shut down and create barriers and stigma. And so from the start, I think it's important to talk about language, because language shapes and conveys attitudes and church policies, you know, whether or whether not to have a mental health forum like you're doing here. So I choose to use the language of mental health challenges, And I just want to name that from the start. And there is big debate about language. What I like about mental health challenges, instead of mental illness or brain disorders or mental health problems, is two things. One, it raises up health as the larger category. We're talking about mental health. Health is the larger human category in which we circulate, we operate, not deficiency, flaw, or something needing remediation, like illness or problem. I use the language of challenge rather than problem, which it could be there, because I like it because it sets up something that's before me, something that's before people, and offers a sense of agency. It doesn't name a factor that defines a person, like illness can be seen as a way that defines a person. Like the term disability, in fact, often ends up being a totalizing, if you know what I mean, an all-encompassing description of who that person is. Mental health challenges, in the language of challenge, may treat it as an ongoing condition, something that's a struggle that I need to find resources to endure through, but it doesn't reify the category. It doesn't objectify it as the total defining character of who I am. On the other hand, sometimes people use the language of illness and find that liberating, because an illness is something that's not necessarily a flaw in me. So I simply say that there's debate out there, and I'm choosing to use the terms mental health challenges to speak of depression, because in a way it opens up the possibility of agency and resilience in my own journey. It's also important for me to avoid the language of battle. Often, you know, mental health battle, a battle to be overcome. And language of overcoming and battle often accompanies mental health challenges. But why I shy away is it reproduces what I call the hero narrative, that I'm on my journey and I'm battling something that I need to overcome. And if in the end I can't, then I'm a failure. And the language of overcoming and the language of battle rings with this kind of triumphalist narrative. So I like challenge in a way that names something that I struggle with, and I'll even say wrestle with, sometimes like Jacob wrestles with the angels, but we could talk about that later. But not something that makes me some sort of hero that if I fail at, and I constantly do, that I'm not okay. And that's, in part of my journey, a serious issue. So it raises the question of stigma. We live in a society where stigma operates in all sorts of ways. We can name it even raising the kind of LGBTQI communities, trans communities, the kind of stigma that goes with it and the mental health challenges. But I've encountered stigma, and in my journey of care with my son, who's now an adult on the autism spectrum, stigma is huge. It's almost like there is a penchant that human beings have to divide people into two categories, normal and abnormal. And there's no in between, and there's no gray area. The normal is the ideal person who can function according to expectations. And we'll talk in a little bit about, well, what's normal? I mean, who defines that? And I think a problem is normal, not abnormal. But the kind of stigmatizing and pathologizing that happens with mental illness can be incredibly debilitating, and often says more about the community doing the rejecting than it does about a person. A community's fear of difference, of not being in control, of feeling uncomfortable with not knowing what to do and not having the right answers. A fear of somehow I'm gonna be a failure in light of another person. Misunderstandings like this often animate stigma. We can come back to that, but I wanna name two terms that often involve stigma. One is diagnosis. Diagnosis is often a part of mental health challenges. You know, in the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, version 5, the DSM-5 is often used to diagnose. On the one hand, this is good. On the other hand, it presents problems. On the good side of it, a diagnosis can allow a person to access care that otherwise isn't accessible. A diagnosis can be strategic. I've learned this in my journey with my son, but also in my journey with depression. A diagnosis can also name something. It names symptoms that have been collected and coordinated and voted on by a community of doctors and pharmacists and so forth, that actually names something that I share with others. And so the power of naming can actually be liberating in one way. It was for me when I finally realized what I was dealing with was depression. That's what it was. It was almost a relief. But then came the other side of it, the kind of danger of reducing a person to their diagnosis. I like saying dignity is larger than diagnosis. The fact of the medical narrative doesn't narrate my whole life. In fact, it's a story within a larger story, a diagnosis is. I am not the sum of depression. There are relationships in my life. There are roles that I have. There are things that I love. There are things that I struggle with that are all maybe related in some sense to the diagnosis, but aren't necessarily defined. So there's danger of reducing a person to the symptoms, to the diagnosis. Tom's depressed. That limits the story that I really am in a larger way, and actually limits the possibility that maybe they're in communities in which I'm involved. Leadership, participation by, with, and for people with mental health challenges can be a very real thing, but often stigma prevents leadership and participation from happening. The other word besides diagnosis that I want to name and sort of call into conversation is medication. There's a lot of conversation about medication. There's an anti-med movement. And the more I read, the more complex I realize it is. But medication is, again, double-edged. On the one hand, medication can relieve genuine suffering because there are biological and neurological things going on. Medication brings relief in cases of schizophrenia and bipolar in a way that allows people literally to survive. And in cases of major depression, it's true as well. Survival is dependent. But medication can also reduce a person to their biology. I've been with psychiatrists that want to throw every med against every problem. If I have a hard week, oh, let's up your dose. Wait a second. So there's the danger, of course, in medication to stigmatize it. You need meds, somehow you're a problem, or you need meds that again, you're reducible to your biology and you are depressed. Biology is real, but often it stigmatizes. So stigmatizing silences, it creates attitudes that alienate and excludes by making a person bear the burden, bear the weight of addressing their own issue, their own suffering as a problem to be fixed and cured. I want to say that again, because often what happens is the person, the stigmatized person, the person that's alienated or silenced, bears the weight of their own being silenced and their own being stigmatized because it's their problem to fix. Take your meds. That med doesn't work, try another thing. And often, I'll confess in my journey, the story is one of piling technique upon technique, piling pill upon pill, some of which fail and don't, but it's all a problem that I somehow need to address. And what that leaves out is the relationship I have with community and others. What that leaves out is my spiritual journey with God. And what that leaves out is my connection with the land, with nature, with the larger creation. So having said that, I just want to end by that first section here, which is the longer one, by talking about the pressure there is for people with mental health challenges to conform to normalcy in getting treated for a condition that forces them to bear the weight of their own suffering. So conforming in order to function normally. But again, what is normally? What is, in fact, I think the normal is what's pathological here. So let me segue, if I could, into my own journey, and we can talk about all this stuff later. I'm just putting some things on the table for us that we might come back to. I first have to acknowledge that the journey of my depression has been secret. Often I've just dealt with it in silence. And the fact that I can talk about it, I need to own the privilege that I bear in doing that. I'm white, cisgendered. There are those who can't tell the story for the fear of the backlash. So it's really important to acknowledge the silence is a very real and living thing among a lot of people with mental health challenges. I'm a tenured professor. That is, my job is relatively secure. There are those who, when they speak about their condition and their mental health challenges, face joblessness or face being alienated in their work. This is a real issue. So the fact that I can do this is itself worth naming among us today. And maybe it's something we can talk about because there are many who can't talk about it, who live in silence and secrecy, and communities, even worship, forces the silence because an understanding of faith is joyful and happy. And if I'm not joyful and happy, then I'm not faithful. And if I have doubts, then somehow I'm not spiritually right. And a lot of people that I've talked to in my journey drop out of church, drop out of faith communities in this light. I first recall experiencing depression actually in elementary school. When my teacher in third grade talked to my mom and asked, "What's wrong with Tommy?" I go through periods of sullenness and withdrawal, and my teacher noticed it. I didn't realize it at the time. I went through off and on years of counseling and therapy, but I didn't know, and it wasn't named depression. And life with my son and journeying with him on the autism spectrum, and there are other diagnoses that accompany that, made me recognize, wait a second. And it was actually the psychiatrist that suggested that I actually should see a psychiatrist, that something's going on. And I learned at that point, and it was almost a relief to know, wow, okay, there's a name for this. And it's not just a melancholy spirit. It's not just laziness. It's not just the inability to sort of, pull myself together after a hard day or get out of bed in the morning. I had some candles lit here and one of them just fell. So I need to be careful about that. It was an incredibly gifted moment when I realized that it was depression and there was a name for it. And yet the names don't describe it. One of the persistent challenges of living with mental health challenge is that words don't describe. There's an experience that defies articulation, that in fact shatters narratives of faith being a journey of happiness. We can talk about that a little bit later, but the difficulty of communicating the experience further exacerbates the isolation. And that's been true with me, which led me to silence. I just sort of dealt with it. I had this other self. And you know, the feelings that I had weren't sadness, a feeling that comes and goes, but more like a pervasive sense of dread. I even read Kierkegaard, the philosopher, you know, dread and anxiety as an existential condition, trying to understand what this is. But I come to terms with it as a kind of mood that endures. It's more like a vague for me, and people journey differently. And what I'm talking about here is chronic depression, not major depression. And there's a distinction that's important. I've slipped close to that several times, but the vague feelings of melancholy that I'm talking about accompany me daily at a kind of low grade level. So I would just describe words like unfocused, fatigue, a weight on me. the urge to withdraw, the sense of being overwhelmed, too porous. Like for a while, the news from our neighbor to the south was affecting my mental health. And I had to limit my diet because I was too porous. It sort of affected me. The sense of being shut down, numb, sense of worthlessness, all of these things sort of endure and accompany life along the way and lead to a sense of feeling at the mercy of forces outside one's control, like an abyss that holds you captive. I keep a journal because I struggle for language. And so some of these, this language comes right out of my journal I'm sharing for the first time ever. And here's the point that I really want to make with you today is part of the second note in the musical chord I hope to play tonight. The split between my private and public life that happened and that continues to happen and happens often in the lives of those with mental health challenges. The split between my inarticulate feelings or the silence on the one hand and my public role. Vice principal at Emmanuel, faculty at Emmanuel, speaking and supposed to be writing and teaching, being a leader. That I managed to do, but the split became really wide and hard for me. And the split, somehow you can't let your private life get in the way of performing of the work. Because if you do, you'll let people down. And the shame of being exposed is a part of that. Letting one's own vulnerable tenderness be a spectacle and face potential shunning, failure of having a problem that I can't contain, of being designated a problem in my community. These things were part of my journey, and it's interesting how I hide, how I have hidden. And kept silence, which imply a couple of things. One, the kind of adopting of the narrative that I am somehow responsible, that I have to take care of this on my own in order to appear along with others. That's a problem. And I think it's a social narrative that's a problem that needs to be addressed. It's interesting how also, I thought of my journey as one of needing to have more faith and spiritual depth. Because if I practiced mindfulness, if I did such and such a technique, then I would be able to keep up and be stable and somehow be normal, function normally in a way that at the end of a day, I just didn't collapse in my living room or wake up in the morning and feel like, oh, I just can't get out of bed. There are resources for resilience that I practice, that I do, but it's interesting how the idea of having to do more and have more faith and yet hiding that side of myself played out. And I think the problem, the big problem, it's not the only problem, is that our highly individualistic consumer-based society measures a person's worth by their ability to perform, by their ability to produce, to be efficient, and to do so constantly, to keep up with an ever speedier, is that a word? Ever quicker pace that actually may be the problem. There are some out there that say it is no wonder mental health challenges occur in a society that atomizes individuals, that makes us separate from one another, and a society that demands more and more productivity, even in COVID. I mean, come on, none of us are operating with all the engine working, but yet we have to have new programs, and yet we have to do this and this. And I'm glad this program is here, James. It's not a criticism of this program, but I watch the kind of pace, and there's a problem with society that the role of Christian faith could have a prophetic to name these problems as part of what produces mental health challenges and produces the private public split and actually places the burden of getting themselves together on people with mental health challenges. So, and here I'll just finish up with a third section. And coming to terms with depression for me has meant actually learning to listen to how my life speaks. That's a phrase from Parker Palmer. He actually uses the word befriending his depression. I resist that, as I confess, for a couple of reasons, but I think coming to terms with, for me, and learning to pay attention to how my life speaks shows me perhaps that there are indicators of issues that I need to speak with, I need to address in my life that may not be my fault, that may not be a problem that's reducible to me getting somehow my act together, but may be pressed upon me. So I can name a number of examples, I'm sure we all can, of how somehow we set up our worlds to be overwhelming for us. I've made decisions that do that. And when I start to feel it, it's a call to me to pay attention. So in one way, depression and the feeling of being pressed, it lets me know that, okay, something's unsustainable for me right now. What circumstances, what can I address that might help me find leverage to push back? I use the word push back. For me, even exercise, like doing push-ups, for me is resilience-inducing thing because it's like pushing. I'm sudden with my body, I'm finding agency. So the metaphor is finding leverage to push back against forces that weigh me down. And for me, that's resilience. It's befriending in a way, but it's not necessarily treating depression as my friend. And I don't think it is. And I think it's dangerous to actually invite others to consider that way too. I think it's a journey that each person may take in different ways for themselves along the way. So to me, it means acknowledging my own vulnerability and my own life speaking to me. But depression isn't the defining attribute of my story. As hard and difficult as it is, when it invites me to pay attention. So I want to say here, it's not another hero story. It's not another story of a technique of overcoming. Somehow, if I pay attention more, and if I did this more regularly, the feelings, the sense of depression would go away. It doesn't. So I think it's really important for me to acknowledge that techniques, pills, all sorts of things are all part of the journey, but the idea of a cure is a dangerous thing for me. And I'll speak of one thing that does help, though, and it relates to my music, the power of lament. And I think Christian communities have lost the power of lament. And I mean that in this way. Lament is a way to bridge private suffering and public community with others and with God. It names something and it joins folks together in the naming. I'll just give an example here. The Psalms, for example, are often for me a way of finding voice expressing something. So I'll just read, what is it I have here? A Psalm 69, just verses 1 through 3. Save me, O God, for the waters have come to my neck. I sink in deep mire where there's no foothold. I've come into deep waters, and the flood sweeps over me. I am weary with my crying. My throat is parched. My eyes grow dim with waiting for my God. When I read that, the psalmist speaks a language that resonates with my experience. And I find something not only that names and expresses, but that joins me to something larger. Another has named this. So I find a sense of community in that, and in a way, comfort. Lament names, it expresses, and in that, it communicates sometimes the incommunicable. It gives voice to something that calls my own inarticulateness into voice. It also can be a vehicle of finding comfort. And so I'll just read a little passage from Psalm 139, which has been a resource for me And speaking again of the waters and the darkness that overflow. Psalm 139, O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest when I sit down and when I rise up. Thou discernest my thoughts from afar. Thou searchest out my path and my lying down and art acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, lo, O Lord, thou knowest altogether. Thou dost beset me behind and before, and layest thy hand on me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Where can I go from thy spirit? Where can I flee from thy presence? If I ascend to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the utmost parts of the sea, even there thy hand shall lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, let only darkness cover me, and the light above me be night, even the darkness is not dark to thee. The night is as bright as day, for darkness is as light with thee. I don't necessarily experience that, but what is powerful to me in that assurance is whether I feel it or not, God is there. The darkness is as light to God, that the waters and the sense of overwhelm is God's presence in and through that. In my own sense of God's absence, if I'm really honest, my severe doubt, my anger, my plea, where are you in my life? There is the sense that even in that doubt, that there is a presence larger than me. And I name that because for me, one of the realities that depression brings is the feeling of being consumed in an isolating, narrowing diminishment where nothing outside myself seems to affect. And the sense that there is something outside of myself, a grace working larger than me, carrying me, is powerful. In fact, I don't have to get it together. It's prophetic in the sense that I don't have to be something I'm not. I don't have to do such technique or feel certain feelings in and through my sense of overwhelm. God is in that sense of absence. And when we think of Jesus enduring the cross, God's solidarity with humanity at a point of desperation, and on Jesus' lips, a psalm of lament, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? God of God's own being is in solidarity. That doesn't take away anything of depression. But what it does for me is provide a net, a kind of grounding that builds resilience in me, builds my capacity for speaking back. I'll name another verse. 2 Corinthians 2:9 for me has become an anchor. It's often thrown around and you may recognize it. And here Paul's talking about a thorn in his side that plagues his own ministry and that he continually asks God to take away. But in his pleas, he hears the voice of Christ say, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. We could spend days talking about the theology here, but for me, I want to highlight the word sufficient. It's enough. There are no lists of things to do or feelings to feel for God's love to envelop. It is enough. God's love carries me. I think of the carrying metaphor often. Grace is that which goes before, paves a way in the wilderness, comes before me. And what this does for me, it undercuts normalcies, expectations of being something or someone else. It's enough for me to be who I am here, in and through my doubt, pleading with God, even angry protest. It's enough. I say again, this doesn't cure. This doesn't take away suffering. or the feelings of being weighed down. But for me, it opens up the possibility to find agency and resilience, not despite, but in my own journey with depression, in my so-called weakness. That's a scary term because often some people are designated weaker than others. And I think we have to tread very cautiously in designating people with mental health challenges as weak or people with disabilities as weak, because that label can re-inscribe stigma. So when I think of weakness, I mean my own challenge as a way of owning up the vulnerable struggle that I have. And in this, coming back to lament, it can be a resource, giving voice, giving expression, but allowing the possibility to move beyond isolation through communicating. And there are two things that I want to end with where faith communities might actually be helpful. One, in faith communities can hold space for lament. And by holding space, I mean providing room for discomfort, becoming comfortable with discomfort, for hearing into voice and using the Psalms of Lament, even for those who may be silenced, because chances are there are silenced voices who might find empowerment in, let's say, hymns of lament, prayers that acknowledge struggle and doubt that are very real in human life. And holding space for lament in this way helps bridge the private and public that I talked about earlier. And in this, through song and in prayer and liturgies, people living with mental health challenges may find a sense of community to come forward and build bridges to participation, which leads to the second suggestion for faith communities. Faith communities can hold space for hearing the stories of people living with mental health challenges, hearing them in the uncertainty of not knowing, of doubt and struggle, that there may not be an answer, simply be present. I like one of my phrases in a class I teach on mission, you know, this, and proclamation. Christianity is always full of words, but really the first gesture is listening. Through listening, the power of speech is brought into being by simply being present and first being silent, without labels, without answers and cures and five techniques to build a happy life of faith, you know, and all those kinds of things. Faith communities can really build a sense of welcome that otherwise may not be possible. And I think healing might even happen. Healing not as a cure or feelings of happiness, but healing as a relation. And I think the Hebrew sense of shalom, about right relation with God, creation, and all our relations, is what's at stake here. And for me in my journey, and I'm happy to talk about a variety of things, music has been a part of that. Nature has been a part of my journey. But I'll end there with those thoughts about possible building bridges of healing through holding space for lament and for listening spaces of hearing stories. So I'll stop there, and realizing there's a lot more that we can talk about, but, and perhaps I've gone on too long.